So today, rethinking healthcare. Dr. Stephen Jenness is a clinical professor and researcher in medical science here at the University of Alberta. He was initially certified in obstetrics and gynecology, and also has done substantial work in the whole area of environmental medicine. The author of over 80 scientific papers published in all the fine medical journals in the English-speaking world, the Lancet, the British Medical Journal, Canadian Medical Association Journal, Public Health, Environmental Research. In addition, he's written and lectured extensively on the whole area of medical ethics and on this question of environmental health, evidence-based medicine related to nutritional science, and on a physician's professional medical obligations. He has also served as the woman's healthcare physician for one of the inner city clinics. So that tells you a little bit about his commitments to the ethical life, and has served as co-director of medical services in a West African hospital. He's received considerable recognition for his teaching and his research, including the commemorative medal from the Governor General in recognition of a significant contribution to our country. But I suppose what he is known primarily for, and I think the second half of today he has invited his colleagues to join him so that you can appreciate this, is that he is part of the doctor's band called the Dixie Docs. So I don't know if they're going to be coming or not, but nice if they did. So he's a musician as well. I always choose my doctors because of their interest in music. And I've found that that is far and above the most suitable way to make a judgment about it. So I'm delighted, Dr. Jenness, that you're with us. The other night at Trinity Lutheran Church, he gave a lecture on this theme. Some of you were there. Today, it will be much shorter, so we can engage in the conversation together. So welcome, and thank you for coming.
Thank you very much, David. Thank you, Martin. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here. I am most certainly not a philosopher. I feel a little bit shy in a room of such erudite philosophers, but I want to share a few ideas about medicine, and I'm very grateful to be here. One of my heroes in medicine is a fellow named Hippocrates, who lived about 400 BC. And in Hippocrates' time, cutting-edge medicine at that time believed that illness was caused by the spirits, and that Zeus would shoot arrows to inflict pain on people. And although we may look back and think that that's kind of misguided, every age thinks it's sophisticated, just like we do, and they thought that they were sophisticated. And the Greeks were the paragons within the medical world. But Hippocrates, whose father was a physician, whose grandfather was a physician, and he himself was also trained, looked around and was concerned about some of the things that were happening medically. And one of the things that was really bothersome to him was that he noticed that there was a lot of corruption that was happening within the profession, and that many doctors were being bribed by business people and political people to poison rivals with the potions that they were dispensing to appease the spirits, as that was the standard of care at that time. And so Hippocrates wrote a document called the Hippocratic Oath that most of us have heard of. And the Hippocratic Oath was based on four fundamental pillars. One, that physicians were accountable to transcendent forces. Secondly, that human life was inviolable from conception until natural death. Third, the whole concept of primum non nocere, which is to not do harm. And finally, that physicians should have a virtuous character. Now, his Hippocratic Oath became sort of a fundamental document in the ethics of medicine for two millennium. But recently, in the 1960s, because of changing values within society, was left behind. But what most people aren't aware of was that the Hippocratic Oath was only one small part of a much larger document that Hippocrates was involved with, called the Hippocratic Corpus. Hippocrates was given the name the father of scientific medicine, not for his writings with regards to the Hippocratic Oath, but was for his assessment of clinical medicine and his subsequent writing in the Hippocratic Corpus. And what he observed as a critical thinker was that there appeared to be patterns, logical patterns of illness. That people who lived in certain part of Greece had different kinds of patterns of illness than in other parts. That people exposed to certain things had higher rates of illness compared to others. That the way people ate had an impact. That the way that their assessment at birth in terms of their integrity and strength at birth, there appeared to be an inherited difference. And so Hippocrates, in his observations, put together a series of writings, and although many of them were primitive, he instituted a paradigm shift in medicine. And rather than accepting this paradigm that illness was caused by the spirits, he wrote this volume with his followers that is, and the basic fundamental tenet was that every illness has a natural cause, and that if you find the cause, perhaps you will be able to effect a cure. So this idea that illness had a natural cause as opposed to being caused by metaphysical forces was a dramatic shift in medicine. And for this, he was honored with the title of being the father of scientific medicine. From taking medical science from being a religion into being a science. And so he was respected for many years. But one of the things that's happened is that as well as getting away from the Hippocratic Oath from an ethical perspective, the world of medicine is increasingly moving away from Hippocrates' fundamental basis of scientific medicine. In that, whereas the focus that he had at that time was on looking for causation of illness, this idea that illness commences because of a cause, illness persists because the cause persists, and illness can only desist or be cured if the cause is addressed. Contemporary medicine has been moving away from that and has been moving into a paradigm of predestination. Now, what do I mean by that? Consider if someone develops a chronic illness, such as they're having issues with their bowels, they're having trouble, they're bleeding, and they go in and they get an assessment and they're given a diagnosis of something such as ulcerative colitis. Or let's say that they have trouble with their joints and have a lot of chronic pain and inflammation, and they're given a title of arthritis. These terms do not tell us what the cause or the source of their affliction is. They simply are ways of describing what the symptoms are. For example, if we say ulcerative colitis, ulcerative simply means that there is ulcers there, and colitis is the Greek word for colon, and itis is inflammation. So it's a sexier way of saying that somebody has, you know, intestines that are inflamed. Or if we said that that somebody has arthritis. I mean, arth is just the Greek word for joint, and itis is just the Greek word for inflammation. But if you go to your physician, the way that medicine is increasingly practiced is that people are given a diagnosis, and then they are treated with drugs, and failing that, surgical interventions are done. I mean, we could look at many things. If a woman goes in with irregular vaginal bleeding, a really common and increasing problem these days, they're often given a nice word label, and then, you know, various hormonal treatments may be tried, and failing those, interventions are done. But this algorithm of assessing the patient, giving a diagnosis, and then instituting treatment misses the whole realm of what is causing this person's problem. What is the source? What is the word we use, the etiology of their problem? Now, why has this fundamental step that Hippocrates instituted so long ago, why has it been increasingly removed when we are assessing people with chronic illness? And the reason is because much of medicine now has evolved into a paradigm of genetic predestination. And that when people have chronic illness, it is often assumed that the source of their problem is genetics. And so if it's just genetics, then we are just these hapless victims of, you know, sort of some cosmic genetic roulette, you know, having the wrong parents who just gave us this. And so all that we have then to address the genetic deficiencies then is to intervene with our chemical potions, our medications, and then our surgery. So much of the approach to chronic illness, whether it's chronic mental illness, such as bipolar illness, schizophrenia, anxiety disorders, depression, people with panic attacks, or people, you know, with a whole spectrum of physical illnesses, is to assess them, to give them a diagnosis, and then to treat them with medication. There has been a lot of attention to the whole field of genomics, and when David and I initially met here to chat about this, we chatted about the increasing attention to identifying people who have this gene or that gene that may predispose them to illness, or this gene and the other gene. But there, in the last number of years, there has been a whole new area of medicine that has been introduced, which many people are not aware of yet. And that is the whole area of molecular medicine and something called epigenetics. Now, epigenetics is a very exciting field because what it is, has been found is that the genes do not act independently to cause illness. But epi, meaning upon, it's now been found that there are many factors that are controlling our genes. So whether a person has a particular gene or not may predispose them to an affliction or predispose them to health. But it is these epigenetic factors that are regulating our genes that will ultimately determine whether people enjoy health or suffer from affliction. And so what has prompted this move into epigenetics? Well, the whole genetic predestination paradigm has recently been shown to be misguided. Why? Well, with a lot of recent evidence, they have found that many identical twins who have the same genome often have completely different health outcomes. So there must be something different that is triggering this. For example, there was a paper a few weeks ago on autoimmune disease, and they found in identical twins very much difference in the outcomes despite the same genetic background. And there was a paper in November of last year looking at Parkinson's disease. Again, 49 identical twins, completely different health outcomes. It's also found that many people have illnesses that nobody in their ancestry has. So if this was supposed to be inherited, who did they inherit it from? And it's also been found that certain illnesses are increasing at a dramatic rate, and I'll mention a couple of those in a minute. But our genes haven't changed. And when you look at some cultures, for example, the older Japanese culture that has a, you know, enjoys a very long lifespan with low rates of chronic illness and lower rates of cancer, when they move to the United States and adopt their lifestyle, their rates of illness increase substantially. And I'm not aware that their genes are changing on the boat on the way over, right? So it has been found that there must be something else that is involved in controlling and causing illness. So this whole area of epigenetics has evolved. And what is being found is that there are certain things that are triggering our genes to cause illness and to allow people to have their health restored. And so what's been found then is that rather this genetic predestination paradigm that much of medicine continues to function within today is misguided. And really, the more accurate paradigm was recently discussed by the Center for Disease Control when they said that virtually all illness represents the complex interaction between our fixed genome and our modifiable environment. Right? In other words, our genomes, we can't yet change them. We don't have genetically modified people yet, right? So we have a fixed genome, but there are environmental factors that are interacting with our genes to determine our health. But the exciting and really hopeful thing there is that we are not predestined to illness then. Because if we can identify those factors within the environment that are triggering illness, okay, and we correct them, then there is the opportunity to be restored. So this new epigenetic movement is really going back. It isn't new. It's very old. In fact, it is restoring us to the Hippocratic model of looking for the cause of things within our environment that is interacting with our genes to affect illness or health. Now, the next question is just before I get into the things in the environment, I'm going to just take one step back. Was this genetic predestination paradigm serving us well? Was it working? Do we have wonderful health care? And that's why of the topic today about rethinking health care. Well, many people believe that we have a wonderful healthcare approach, that it is the envy of others, and that it is something that we should continue. And there is much attention to preserving the healthcare system that we have. But if you look at the science, and in terms of what's happening in public health, there are a lot of concerns. There's concerns about the economics and so on, but a lot of the concerns about the economics and the sustainability of healthcare is because of what's happening with health. The major problem with healthcare is declining health of the population. Now, you may say to me, come on, how can that be? Because it's so counterintuitive. Most people believe that we have, you know, abundant health. We have people who are healthier and are living longer, and so it's fantastic. But if you actually look behind that appearance, the truth is a little bit different if you look at the science. Let's talk about life expectancy, for example. People have suggested we've had a dramatic increase in life expectancy over the last few decades as an indication of how well we're doing. And that's the most common question I get asked when I'm speaking to a medical crowd. Well, if you look at life expectancy, we have had a dramatic increase over the last 50 to 60 years. It's gone up substantially. But most of that is because of dramatic improvements in acute care. Most of medicine now, 80% of healthcare in Canada, relates to chronic illness. We have exceptional acute care medicine. The issue is the chronic care. But to get back to the figures, let me tell you. If we're calculating life expectancy, how do we do that? Well, we total up the ages at which people die, and we divide by the number, and then we come out with an average. So if we took one person who died at 90 and another at 80, we total it up to 170, divide by 2, the life expectancy then is 85. But the big increase in life expectancy has occurred because of a dramatic improvement in care for infants. The death rate, infant mortality rate, over the last 60 years has dropped by almost 90%. So, if you take someone who dies at 90 and a baby dying at 0, your average life expectancy is only 45. So when you drop all those children who are no longer dying because of incredible acute care interventions in their life, all of a sudden the life expectancy bounces way up. So the dramatic increase in life expectancy is because of huge improvement in neonatal care and infant care. If you really want to look at life expectancy, what you need to do is look at life expectancy at age 60. Okay? And if you look, say, we'll go from 1951 to 2011, 60 years, the life expectancy increases for both men and women have gone up by 5 years in both men and women. But most of that is because of acute care, management of trauma, cardiac events, infectious disease. So we've had a dramatic change in life expectancy because of our acute care abilities. If we actually look at chronic disease, the incidence is increasing dramatically. Let me give you some examples. The McLeans from this week, the broken generation, a shocking number of Canadian students feel depressed, even suicidal. When I went to medical school, I was taught that mental illness afflicts about 1 in 20 people. Recently, the figures are about 1 in 4 to 1 in 5. Chronic illness. Just along that vein, if we look at autism in children, for example, chronic neuropsychiatric disorder. It used to be a relatively rare condition in 1985, 1 in 2,500. Okay? It has steadily gone up. 1995, about 1 in 350. Okay? 2001, 1 in 150. Right? So if we're looking at some of the recent figures, I think 2005 UK figures, 1 in 64. Minnesota, 2011 figures in the US, 1 in 56 children. In the Somali community, 1 in 28 children with autism. Okay? And some people say, oh, it's just because we've liberalized the diagnosis of autism. Okay? But there's been papers that have looked at that, and that just isn't the case. That may account for a 10 or 20% increase, but not for an increase of over 3,000%. Okay? If we look at all kinds of illnesses in the elderly, we're seeing increasing rates of dementia and Alzheimer's. In women, increasing rates of gynecologic problems. Cancer rates are going up in the young as well as in the old. Pediatric cancer is increasing. If we look at inflammatory bowel disease in children, it's gone up tenfold in the last 10 years. So it's not just because we have an aging population. A lot of these afflictions are occurring in young people. Right? Okay. So the reality is that we have declining health in the population. And it's interesting because we have declining health at a time when we have unprecedented amounts of money and resources spent on health care. If you think about the billions, I mean, I'll just tell you, in Canada, in 1975, the federal expense on health care was $12.2 billion. Okay? In 2011, it's over $200 billion. Okay? So we have unprecedented amounts of money spent on health care, on research, okay, on cancer programs. You think about the number of runathons and telethons and all kinds of things devoted. And are we winning? My friends, the rates of these chronic illnesses are increasing. And the federal government, just a few years ago, released a statement from the Public Health Agency that we have increasing rates of illness that are challenging the sustainability of our healthcare system. This isn't my idea. The medical literature is talking about Ron Horton, the editor of The Lancet, one of the leading journals in the medical world, talking about the neglected epidemic of chronic disease. In the Journal of the American Medical Association journal, most widely read journal in the world, they talk about, when they were talking about children's chronic illness, they say that our society is not prepared for the increasing demands that are going to occur as a result of these increasing rates of chronic illness. So it's being discussed in the medical literature. It is being recognized at government levels. And so the issue then comes to is, what is causing this increase in chronic illness? Because if you assume that it's genetic, okay, and just throw interventions at it, as rates of illness continue to rise, we're going to see continued rates with continued consumption of services, inadequate physicians to deal with the problems. And that's what we have now, is we have many people who don't have physicians. And the other intriguing thing is that now more people are seeing alternative health providers that they have to pay for out of their own pocket than there are visits to primary care physicians. Okay? So if we come back to this paradigm of epigenetics, so looking at what is causing all this affliction. So we said then that we have this one circle of our genome. We can be predisposed. For example, my dad has diabetes, so I may be more predisposed to that, right? But what will turn on the illness or not is what's occurring in this modifiable environment. Now, within this environment, there's been a new term that's come out called the exposome. And the exposome refers to the totality of factors in the environment that are interacting with our genes to cause illness. And what's been found, essentially, is that there are just two things within that environment that are interacting with our genes to cause illness. Okay? And a simplistic way of putting that is that any functional system, whether it's your cat, your tree, your machine or yourself, any functional system, in order to thrive, it has to get the things that it needs, and you have to keep it away from things that harm it. Okay? So there are certain things that if the unit is deficient in, it can't thrive, and if there are things that are harming it, it can't thrive either. And that's what has been found in this area of epigenetics, is that deficiencies of certain items will trigger illness, and toxicity of various things in our environment can cause health problems. Okay? So in terms of the totality and the accumulated wisdom of medical history from the time of Hippocrates, if you look about the kind of things that have been found through medical history that cause illness, there's only a few. We see the father of toxicology, a fellow named Paracelsus, in the 1400s, found that toxins can cause illness when he was seeing that miners being exposed to certain things cause illness. There's a fellow named Lind in the 1700s who worked on the British Navy, who found that sailors who didn't eat citrus fruits developed scurvy, and found that deficiency caused illness. So toxicity causes illness. Deficiency causes illness. Then Mendel came along, the Augustinian priest, and with his research on plants found that genetics is involved in illness. That's the third factor. The fourth factor was discovered by a fellow named Semmelweis, who was an obstetrician, and Pasteur, who was the father of the germ theory, where they found that germs cause illness. And so medicine adopted the germ paradigm for many years. And then finally, Freud and a number of others in the 19th century, finding that psychological factors can impact illness. But throughout the history of medicine, there is only these five things that have been identified in the medical literature as the causes of illness. And those are the same things which we are now being reestablished in this epigenetic paradigm, that things that are we are deficient in will lead to illness, that deficiencies will impair gene function. And I'm going to give an example just in a minute. And that various toxicities, whether they're germ toxins or whether they're psychological toxins, will also interact with our genes to cause illness. So, the hopeful thing then is that for people who have chronic illness, if you are able to investigate and to determine what it is within this exposome that is disordered, and you correct it, then many people with chronic illness will have the ability to be restored. In that our body is a self-healing machine, and if they have their exposome corrected, they'll be able to be restored. So, let me give you just a couple of practical examples, and then we can go in whichever direction you would like. In terms of deficiencies, many people will say, I will say that, well, doesn't every doctor know this? The reality is that the whole deficiency thing was removed from medical education a number of years ago because there was the assumption made that everybody in the Western world has abundant amounts of food. We're getting all that we need from our foods. People aren't deficient here except in exceptional circumstances. So why would we focus on deficiency if this is not a cause of illness? So that was left behind in medical education. The second area with regards to toxicology is that the assumption was that people aren't being poisoned anymore. Yes, we may need a few toxicologists who specialize in this area to address concerns for the exceptional person who may have an exposure somewhere, but the average doc isn't dealing with exposures all over the place, and so this is not something that we need to focus on. So the whole area of deficiency and toxicity has been left behind. And so, unfortunately, most physicians are not apprised of this emerging information about the causes of disease. Now, is that true that there aren't many people who are deficient in things in our culture? And I must say that it isn't true. And the science and the literature is showing that there are a number of things that people are commonly deficient in. Let me just mention a couple. First, as I mentioned the other day on Wednesday, is vitamin D. Okay? Vitamin D is a hormone. It's an essential compound that we require. And recently it's been shown that this compound is involved in regulation of over 2,770 genes. Okay? So it's no minor player in here. It's involved in all kinds of things. And if a person is deficient in vitamin D, there's, you know, a plethora of papers showing a whole variety of problems, from chronic back pain to a multitude of cancers to polycystic ovaries with gynecologic problems to visual problems to dental issues to MS and on it goes. Now, but where would people get vitamin D from? We normally get it from exposure to direct sunlight. And the sunlight emits an electrical frequency which acts on the cholesterol in our skin to manufacture vitamin D, and then we absorb it through our skin. Okay? But recent studies in Canada are showing that the majority of Canadians are very deficient, whereas a optimal level may be from about 120 to 200 nanomoles per liter, of according to some experts, right? In Canada, the average is around 67, okay? And many people have lower levels. In fact, I was involved in some research in the Edmonton area, and we tested close to 1,500 people. And we found that the average was in that range and that the majority of people were low. And we had some people who had levels like, you know, in the teens and in the 20s. Now, what's the significance of this? Like, what does low vitamin D practically do? Well, let me just mention just a couple things to show you the impact of this. There was a study reported in a major journal recently where they were looking at cancer in women. And they did a double-blind, randomized controlled trial where they took a group of women, split them into two postmenopausal women. Neither the patient nor the prescriber knew who was getting the vitamin D and who was getting the placebo, right? And they followed these women for a number of years. And they found in years 2 to 5 after starting the vitamin D, those who got the vitamin D had a 77% less risk of getting any kind of cancer. Any kind of cancer. You may know about colorectal cancer. Colorectal cancer is increasing very substantially in the Western world. So that recently there have been recommendations to test people annually, looking for blood. And some people are recommending colonoscopies, where they put a scope up to look to see if there's any sign of developing cancer, in order to pick it up early before it is spread. And the published objective of the colorectal screening is to, over the next number of years, diminish mortality or death from colorectal cancer by 13 to 15%. That's the objective, right? But a study was published in The Lancet. Okay, it's not the National Enquirer. The Lancet is a leading journal in the world. It was over 25,000 people that they were looking at prospectively. And they looked at people with high vitamin D levels and low vitamin D levels. And they found those with the higher vitamin D levels had a 75 to 80% less risk of ever catching colorectal cancer, right? So this is just one example of a very common deficiency. Now, why would Canadians be deficient? Because often we're an indoor culture, right? We're not outside as much. Where we live, we're further north, and it's harder to be outside in the wintertime as much to get direct sunlight on a lot of our skin. People are putting clothes to cover themselves up to protect themselves, allegedly, from the sun. They're putting a lotion on which will block it. And so many people are deficient. Right? Another example would be a compound called DHA, or docosahexaenoic acid. And this is what's called an omega-3 essential fatty acid. And many people are deficient in this compound called DHA. But recently, this essential nutrient is being found to be involved in many, many processes of it. Deficiency of DHA is involved in brain development in children. And so deficiency is associated with impaired brain development. It's been associated with premature labor, which has increased at a dramatic rate in this province and in many places in the Western world. Deficiency of DHA has a profound impact on mood and has been associated with various psychiatric disorders. Okay, and so, but why would people be deficient in this nutrient? Because it's not found in very many things, and it's predominantly in seafood. And so if people aren't getting seafood, as many people aren't, then they're often deficient in DHA. But there's been a concern about eating a lot of seafood because of the massive contamination, because of all the toxicity going into the water, right? So there have been warnings for pregnant women with regards to seafood. So some people who hear these warnings and are concerned about contamination and the accumulation of all kinds of compounds in fish aren't eating it. And so unless they have another source of getting the DHA, all kinds of people are deficient in this basic nutrient that's required for many physiological functions. So you can begin to see that deficiencies is a significant and ever-present concern all around us.
And I will tell you that I do testing on people, and many, if not most people, are low on these. The second point I'll just say as a last thing is the whole area of toxicity. Now, people assume, well, what do you mean toxins? We're not poisoned. But there is emerging evidence in Canadian, in American, and science and research throughout the world that people are being exposed to chemical toxins all around us. I mean, I could give you all kinds of examples, you know, from the treatments in the carpets that you have, to some of the flame retardants in your beds, to the sprays, to the stuff in the deodorants, to cleaning fluids, to the pesticides that are used that are, you know, go into people's houses, and some other, I mean, there are tens of thousands of chemicals that have been released into the environment, and they're getting into foods, into water, because what's in the water? I mean, all the pharmaceutical things that people take, they go down the drain, down the toilet, and into the water, right? I mean, the birth control pill. One of my colleagues in Texas has been doing some research on exhaled testing for toxicants in the breath of people. And he's found all kinds of stuff coming out in the breath of people, including the birth control pill in men, right? Because where does the pill go? When, you know, 85 to 90% of women in our culture have taken the pill, where does it go? They pee it out into the water supply, right? So it gets into the fish, and that's why it can compromise fish stocks and can alter the development of fish. So many fish now, you can't tell their gender. That's been a concern. The water treatment plants don't have the ability to completely remove this stuff, so it gets into drinking water. People get it, and they breathe it out, right? Because the body is trying to eliminate it. So we have all kinds of toxins. But to put this in perspective, the American Red Cross recently did a study on cord bloods of newborn children. Okay, newborn children. And they tested for a few hundred chemicals. They simply took the cord right at the time of birth, took some blood, so the child didn't have a chance to be exposed to anything. And they found that the average baby had 287 industrial pollutants in its system at birth. Okay, published stuff. Okay, and that's just for the few hundred chemicals they tested for. You may have heard of the thing about BPA, right? BPA is a compound that is in certain kind of plastics, and it leaches into the fluid. And most of, you know, a lot of the baby bottles in the past were loaded with BPA. And so that hormonally active chemical leaches into the fluid, and then people take it in. Now people think, well, the levels of these compounds are so small. How could they have any impact? But that's not what the science is showing. Some of these compounds, the body has a very hard time eliminating. And they accumulate. And if we look at our own inherent biochemistry, the compounds in our body, our hormones in that, our thyroid, I mean, all these various compounds, they work in parts per billion to do their job. So if you get exposed to compounds in parts per billion or parts per million, and these compounds accumulate, they have the ability to interfere with your normal biochemistry. And the Center for Disease Control recently looked at the American population, did widespread testing, and found extensive evidence of bioaccumulated toxicants in men, women, and children. Right? So this is increasingly the rule. So the reality is that these compounds can act many ways. Some of them act on the genes to control gene function, to alter genes. And there was just a paper that came out 2 weeks ago looking at transgenerational transmission of BPA and the fact that it alters gene regulation, and that altered gene can pass, they found in animals, for multiple generations now, right? Which is really concerning information, right? And so this is a whole new area in terms of being able to realize what some of these compounds are doing. Now, is this some far-out idea? No. The Alberta government, the Canadian government, Department of Public Health here in Alberta, there is extensive research going on. I recently spoke at a toxicology conference in Kananaskis, and there was the toxicology group, and there was the public health group. And, you know, we talked about these very concerning issues that are going on with exposure to people, and particularly in pregnancy, because these compounds are going through to babies, and some of them are altering neurodevelopment, as well as various other things. So, in conclusion, let me say that although I bring a bit of a concerning message, as I've spoken about for the last few minutes, I want to conclude with a hopeful message. I practice environmental medicine, and what I do, I spend half my time doing research and with people from the U of A and other places, and the other half time I do clinical work, and so I'm privileged because I get to see what's going on in the research world and to try to adopt it into clinical practice. And the reality is that if you investigate people and you correct this exposome by identifying, are they getting what they need to thrive? And by addressing what's harming them, that if you address those clinically by doing the necessary investigations and interventions, that many people will heal and will be restored. It's incredible to see. And so maybe I'll end it there, and we can discuss and go in whichever direction that you would like.
Thanks so much. As you recall, our pattern is to invite you to raise a theme, speak to a theme or an issue, and then I would like to ask others who are interested in that particular theme or issue to also raise their hand, and I'll give you a chance to enter into that part of the conversation. And after a little while, we'll move to a new theme or issue as you're inclined. So, who would like to be first and put the first theme or issue on the table here?
Sometimes when you see a real-life example to an academic presentation, it can illustrate things very well. And I would say that I am proof that what Dr. Gina is saying is 100% dead-on accurate. I've got chronic fatigue syndrome, and it was a very severe case of it. And regular medicine, in particular pharmaceuticals, did nothing for me. And for the past 5 years, I've been seeing a naturopath, and I've seen very dramatic results. And the naturopath has been using exactly the same methods and techniques that Dr. Genis has been talking about here, particularly vitamin D and omega-3s, along with other things. And just to illustrate it, I'll tell you where I was about 5 years ago and where I am now. And 5 years ago, I was sleeping about 22 hours a day. I went about 10 years not being able to watch TV. I couldn't read, despite having 2 degrees. Now, I sleep about 9 hours a day. I go for a 30-block walk every day, even in the wintertime, right up to a temperature of minus 18. I watch about between 6 and 8 hours of TV a day, and I'm reading a fair bit. And just the simple fact that I'm here at Philosopher's Cafe, paying attention to it, when I couldn't in the past, couldn't pay attention to even the slightest, easiest TV program, in the past would have been absolutely unthinkable. And all of it has happened as a result of natural health and natural healing practices, as Dr. Genis has been describing here. So it's absolutely dead on, 100% accurate. So. Congratulations on diverging from the medical model. I used to be part of that. I was in, ironically, pharmaceutical sales. And so I was trained in the medical model. And I think that's one of the reasons why I got sick was a combination of very high stress from a job and also a very high stress marriage. And so I used to be very heavily oriented in the strict medical pharmaceutical model and seeing chemicals as the way to heal everything. And I've certainly seen now from my own experience that the things that he's been talking about are absolutely dead on accurate. And thank you.
Thank you, and congratulations. It's wonderful.
You might want to watch that television watching, however.
Yeah.
As another form of toxicity. Anyone else want to dip their oar into this particular part of the...
Thank you. Just an observation from my own point of view. I have to agree, I've seen a one-year-old granddaughter who's been diagnosed with epilepsy, but they don't call it epilepsy. She has seizures, and apparently that's becoming more the norm than it's ever been, and it's really frightening. And I have a 22-year-old son who had stomach cancer, and I'm sitting here wondering, okay, what's going wrong with this world? Why are these things happening? And I absolutely believe every single word you said, because there has to be a logical explanation for what's happening, because I know it's not genetic or whatever. It has to be something on the exterior that's impacting these people. That's all I have to say. It's really frightening.
Thank you very much for your comment. I am going to say, with regards to seizures disorders, I've been privileged to see a few people with seizure disorders, and if you explore the underlying...
Just a little louder.
I was just going to say, with regards to seizure disorders, because you mentioned the one-year-old family member, that, you know, I'm very hopeful when I see people who have inexplicable seizure disorders, because if you explore what they're deficient in and toxic exposures and you address them, it often makes a remarkable difference and often the end of their seizures. So there is wonderful hope there. Yes, ma'am.
You're not really allowed to do anything. It took 3 visits to the stallery before they even came down and said, oh, and she saw a neurologist, and now they've got her on phenobarbital, and they said, oh, go home, give her this every day, and in 2 years she'll be fine. So I'm kind of railing against the system, wondering, you know, what can I as a grandparent do and suggest to maybe address this? It's really frightening the way it was handled. Phenobarbital has been around for years, I accept that, but for a small child to be ingesting that for the predicted 2 years makes me question what the long-term effects of that are going to be. And what can I do to maybe make the kids look at other options?
Let me just say that in general, without getting into specifics about any particular case, the question is, How do we affect change? How do we get people to consider and evaluate the science that's going on? And let me say, that's a real challenge. If you look at the history of medicine, it's usually 1 to 2 generations before new information that is in the scientific literature makes its way to the streets. And there are many examples I could give you throughout history, but I'll just give one most recent one, and that is with regards to ulcer disease. When I went to medical school, I was taught that ulcers were caused by having a dominant mother and a very stressful life. And I had a dominant mother and a very stressful life, so I thought that I could feel the pain when I heard this. So anyways, what happened, though, is that there was a couple of guys from Australia, Warren and Marshall, who discovered that ulcer disease, in fact, was related to an infection called H. pylori. Now, in 1983, they presented at an international meeting in Brussels, a GI meeting. But despite the fact that they had data, they were basically ignored and laughed at, and it were rejected. They tried to get into the medical literature and were unsuccessful for a while. Barry Marshall was very frustrated, so he drank some H. pylori himself, gave himself an ulcer, and then treated it to get rid of it. But still, they were ignored. They finally got into the Lancet in 1984, publication. Okay? But it was 10 years, 1990 before, coincidentally, when the drug patent expired on the drug that was being used, that the medical community achieved consensus that, yes, these guys were right. But despite them achieving consensus in 1994, most physicians were still not aware, even though there was massive discussion in the scientific literature. And so the Center for Disease Control, in I think it was 1997, started a campaign. And what they did is they did a
medical campaign, but what they really went after was the public. And when they went after the public campaign, people started then going to their doctors. Well, should I be tested for this and stuff like that? And it promoted change. And in 2005, they won the Nobel Prize in medicine for what they had found a generation before. And this is, I mean, just one more quick example. At the University here of Alberta, there was a doctor, wonderful lady, who started a program called Do Bugs Need Drugs? Okay, Edith Blondell Hill, infectious disease. A lot of people have prescribed antibiotics like anything, and there has been concern about that. Because for a number of reasons, it damages the flora of the gut, which you need for all kinds of reasons. It causes antibiotic-resistant problems. Anyway, so she started this program, Do Bugs Need Drugs? Wrote a book, had presentations, gave medical education credits, but really was not very successful at changing minds. She was frustrated. She didn't have much money left. So she hired a bunch of university students, taught them how to teach little kids. So it took these university students, they went into grade 2 classrooms in a particular, I think it was Grand Prairie, in Alberta, and would tell the children, well, you know, most bugs don't need antibiotics. Most coughs and colds, they often are caused by viruses. Told them questions that they could ask their doctor, gave them information to take home. And overnight, the use of antibiotics in that community went boom, right down, right? So how do we get people to listen? Unfortunately, we need to go to the public to apprise them so that they can begin to request and be informed and ask the necessary questions. Thank you.
Nicholas.
Well, that leads to some further thoughts about public policy. Because it seems to me that a lot of the changes, I mean, there's no point in scattering toxins in the environment from any point of view, but to recognize them and prevent contamination seems to me to require some kind of social or political action. I have to admit that I use deodorant, and every time I use deodorant, I think, what am I doing to the environment? You must have reflected on this, and I'd be grateful if you'd share some of your reflections.
Well, sure. First of all, my reflections on deodorant. Most of the deodorants have aluminum in them. And aluminum is what's called a metalloestrogen, right? And so if it says alum or aluminum, when you apply it, the aluminum absorbs, and it has an estrogenic action in the body, and it can accumulate. And there is a researcher, Darbre, I believe, in out of the UK, who's been expressing concern about accumulation in women's breasts in this area where most of the breast cancers occur. So there is concern about aluminum accumulation with regards to that. There are all other deodorants which are very effective that do not have these kind of toxins in them. So you can still go around using your deodorant, but one that is safe and less toxic. That's that. With regards to public policy, I am no politician, but I definitely agree with you that political action is required in terms of medical education, as well as addressing the causes of illness from a public health perspective. And I really believe that we need influence there. But when I was speaking in Kananaskis, and some of the public health people were there, and we were having a wonderful chat, I was speaking to one of them, a very kind and sincere man, and I brought this issue up. You know, we know this is going on. Like, what? And he said to me in a kind way, he said, there is a lot more than science that goes into public policy decisions. Right? There's a lot more than science. There's economics, right? There is vested interests. There is what the population will tolerate. There is ideology, right? And so we have this whole pie of various things that go into making a decision. So I most certainly would like to see our public officials move full steam ahead in this area, but there are other influences that are impeding that movement. Thank you.
You want to pick up on that, Nick?
Well, and by the way, you always smell like a rose.
Well, I'm very relieved to discover that I don't have to stink in order to be decent to the environment. But perhaps if one were taking that further, I find it very difficult when I'm confronted with a great rack of deodorants to know which ones are okay and which ones are pernicious. I feel the same way about toothpaste. The other day I had to buy another tube of toothpaste, and there's this bewildering array of toothpaste, all of which completely prevent any problems with your teeth. So perhaps there's a deficit of information there, and that might be one approach that would help to alleviate, if not eliminate, the basic problem.
Absolutely, thank you very much. That's a really important comment. And with the discussion regarding that, do bugs need drugs at the grade 2 level, I think that that's one model that would be wonderful to adopt, in that we want to have a healthy population. And the more that we educate our young children about habits of health that they can go home to educate their families with, I think that much better off we will be. And so I completely agree with you that we need public education and we need education in schools, because we're in trouble from a health point of view. And I think that that's one avenue that would have a great reward if it was instituted. Thank you.
In March, when I went for my general exam with my family doctor, I got called back. And the doctor had found that my hemoglobin was way, way down. More tests revealed that I didn't have vitamin B12.
Right.
And since then, several months, I've had an injection of vitamin B12. I'm still not up to normal. But I'd like to know two things. First of all, how many people go for a general exam in Edmonton, have a family doctor? And secondly, why? Why am I not absorbing vitamin B12 through the intestinal tract?
Okay. Once again, I did
also ask Dr. Janice to bring his prescription pad with him.
Without going into specific individual things, I'll make some general comments. First of all, with regards to physicians, most of my colleagues are wonderful people who sincerely want to do the best that they can to help people. And it's great that your doctor tested for vitamin B12, because it's a very common deficiency. But the reality is that most physicians have not been apprised of this emerging information. And so they don't know about a lot of the nutritional information and a lot of the toxicology stuff. So many of them don't have the resources, and they can only give what they've been trained. It's not because, you know, they're being deficient or something. It's just they haven't learned the information yet. It's great that your doctor did that kind of investigation. Now, specifically with regards to B12. Vitamin B12 is an essential nutrient that's involved in many things in the body. Can affect nerve function, can affect hemoglobin, can affect energy, mood, all kinds of things. It is involved in a lot of physiological processes. But most of the vitamin B12 is produced by germs in the gut. Okay? By germs in the gut. There is a project
that has recently been commenced, funded by the National Institute of Health in the United States. And it's replaced the Human Genome Project, and now we have the Human Microbiome Project. Whereas the Human Genome Project was looking to map out the human genome, the Microbiome Project is looking to map out the germ environment of the body. And it is fascinating, the unfolding information. I was speaking at a conference in the U.S., and there was a couple guys from Boston who were involved in the research, and so I was getting some of the latest. It's fascinating stuff. But simply put, it's been found that we have 10 times as many good germs in our body as we have cells. And there's this whole living environment, and that environment is doing many, many, many things. Some are involved in weight regulation, protecting from infections, eliminating toxic compounds, and some are even involved in neurotransmitter production and release by the brain. That's how important they are. And we're just beginning to find out what these things do. But many people have their germ environment damaged, something we call dysbiosis, where it is altered. And that dysbiosis can occur from things such as use of antibiotics, which kill germs, by water that has compounds in it that kill germs, right? And so by various other agents that can damage the germ environment, more and more is being found. And so many people have had their germ environment altered by various things, and thus they may not be producing B12 properly, okay? Some aren't absorbing it properly for various reasons involving the gut. So there's a whole constellation of potential things that may be determining why specifically in you that's lower, okay? One other thing I'm just going to give a hint though, they do have sublingual vitamin B12 preparations. You just stick them under the tongue, you leave them there for 10 or 15 minutes, and they absorb, so it doesn't have to go into your stomach, and you can build up your B12 level that way. So that's just a little hint for some people that may want to consider it.
Okay. The other evening, you commented on this matter that it's not only the need to have the nutrient, it is also about whether your body is capable of taking it up.
Right.
And a bunch of issues associated with that. Can you just make a comment on that?
Thanks, David. The question is this assumption that was made in medical education that we don't need to teach about nutrition because, you know, everybody gets all they need here, so it's not a big issue, makes an assumption that what you put in your mouth is equivalent to your nutritional status. And the recent evidence is showing that that just isn't so. Once you put things into your mouth, they then have to be digested. Digested means they have to be broken down into a form that the body can recognize and take in. And that requires a lot of effort and energy on the part of the body. It requires these molecules, these protein molecules called enzymes, and there's different kinds of enzymes. So if people have any issue with, you know, their levels of protein, or if they have energy issues so that they can't make these properly, they may have digestive disturbances so they can't break down the intake of food. Then after that, then they have to be absorbed. So there are various kinds of transport mechanisms that then take these digested compounds and take them into the body. And if there's any irregularity there, if there's dysfunction because of certain toxicants in the intestinal tract, for example, then you can have absorptive problems. If there's inflammation in the gut for one reason or another, like for one example, some people react to gluten, and they may have inflammation, thus they don't absorb properly. And then after things are absorbed, they have to be assimilated into the body and taken into the site where they're needed and into the cells. From there, they have to be utilized by the particular place that needs them. And there are some things that can interfere with that. And only at the end of all of that do we have a person's nutritional status. So each of these steps is critical in determining a person's nutritional status.
And anything that would interfere along the way will cause issues. So you may have a person, and I've seen a number of people, who eat wonderfully, you know, who are eating incredible stuff, really healthy, but their nutritional status may be severely compromised because of some defect on the pathway. And so we really need to educate our healthcare professionals about the basic nutrients of the body. I mean, we are a nutrient machine. That's what we are. And so, I mean, consider if somebody went to become an architect, right? And the architect you would expect would know all about building materials because you're dependent on that architect for the integrity of your building. If somebody said that you would graduate from architecture school without learning about basic building materials, you'd say, that doesn't make any sense. That's crazy. Yet, in medical school, we're graduating people from medical school, and they haven't learned about the basic building blocks and how to use them and how to investigate when there's abnormalities and how to address those abnormalities when they graduate from medical school. I think it's time for a realignment in our medical education. Thanks, David.
How much time in medical education is spent on nutrition, and how much time is spent on pharmacology by comparison?
I think it's been well supported in the medical literature that there really is very little attention to nutrition and preventative illness, that most of it is intervention. And so the focus of medicine for the most part has shifted from this Hippocratic model of let's find the cause and address that to let's use an intervention. And what interventions do we have to address the situation? And I think we need a revision here.
What would you suggest is the process that we can follow to be able to identify those things, the deficiencies, and get some results or action?
Thank you, ma'am. I mean, there's two sources. One is to learn yourself and to become responsible for your health by doing all that you can to read in this area. And there is an abundance of literature emerging that is available in the medical literature as well as on the internet. And sometimes it's hard to, you know, glean truth from some stuff that's marketing and stuff like that. But there is a lot of information. And if you find people that you can trust and read their information, it's often very instructive. And if anything that I've said today makes any sense, some of my papers are online. If you just go to Google Scholar, there's a number of papers there, and a number of them are open access, so you can just read some of the information to begin to get an understanding of some of these concepts. The second is to find a health provider who is apprised of this information, and if you find someone who will work with you, they're invaluable. So, self-education and getting help.
Okay. Does that address it for you? There's several in the queue here. I'll take a note.
I'm wondering if you could elaborate a little bit on the similarities and differences between naturopathy and environmental medicine.
Thank you very much. I had a privilege a couple years ago to speak at the International Naturopathic or Canadian Naturopathic Conference in Calgary, and it was my first experience speaking at a naturopathic conference, and I didn't know what to expect, and I must say that I was extremely impressed because many of the people there were way further along and had been educated about the whole area of, you know, the biochemistry of the body from a nutritional point of view and how to address it, and had at least some inkling and education about the whole area of toxicity. And so I was very impressed by many of the people that I met there. In terms of, there has been a divide about the whole area of what's called, you know, conventional medicine and alternative medicine. And I have a problem with that divide. I don't think it's legitimate. because, you know, what's alternative medicine? Hippocrates was an alternative health provider in his day. You know, anybody who does anything different, is often labeled an alternative provider. But the heroes of medicine throughout history who contributed the most are all always people who challenged the conventional wisdom. So I don't like this artificial divide, but I will say that I do very much believe in science, and I believe in the scientific medicine. I'm a very much a supporter of, you know, reproducible experimentation and observation and stuff like that. And so, philosophically, I think that medicine claims to be committed to a scientific approach, but I would say that much of it is behind in catching up to the science that's in the medical literature. So I look forward to the day that it does catch up. In the naturopathic world, I do have some concerns about some of the alternative therapies that are being used. Many do not have scientific support, and I like to see that. This morning when I was driving, I teach a class on Saturday mornings, there were three of my six radio stations, they were advertising various supplements for everything under the sun. And sometimes, because there's so many sick and hurting people, often they will bounce around from practitioner to practitioner and try this, that, and the other thing. And that's a concern for me, too. So to answer your question, as I've jumped all over the place here, I think a lot depends on the individual you're seeing. And as long as they're doing good stuff that's in line with the scientific process, regardless of what their label is, whether it's osteopath, medical doctor, naturopath, chiropractor, if they're addressing things in a scientific and respectful way to help people look for the cause of illness, I'm very supportive of it.
Is that no?
Yes. I'm concluding from all that I've heard that the routine annual checkup that I get may not be thoroughly testing, providing the information that I need. So I'm wondering, is there any other way of finding a practitioner who will do that kind of testing other than actually having an appointment and spending whatever time you need to make a decision whether that person is has this knowledge that you're talking about? How does one choose amongst the practitioners somebody that you can depend on?
And that's a very difficult thing for me to answer, because although most of my colleagues are wonderful people, they just haven't been given this information yet. And so, it's a process. There is the beginnings of some places. I've had the opportunity to speak at some medical schools, and there is interest. And I have, for example, on Monday, I have a family physician resident coming to work with me in my office. And so I've had some people who've done electives with me who are really intrigued and are beginning to adopt it. We're just at the beginning stages in this continuum of research science in the literature to clinical practice in the streets. And so I wish I had an easy answer for you. And I will tell you that a lot of the investigations are not covered by healthcare either. And so that creates another dilemma. Because if people come in and they require, an extensive biochemical testing that isn't available, or toxicological testing that's not covered, then patients who are then responsible for it themselves. And many people who I see are people who are disabled or are struggling and don't not necessarily have the resources for these things. And so we have a long way to go. So I wish I had a better answer for you.
Thank you for all the information you're providing. I'd just like you to comment on a couple of things. One is the economics of healthcare as we're talking about it. We're talking about Something that we haven't discussed is the lack of physicians that we have, particularly in family practice. And yet, when we see the students are graduating, more and more are graduating and are going into specialized fields. So there's a, you know, we don't have as many family physicians. So what are the governments or the politicians or the doctors' associations doing to perhaps help those who come from other parts of the world who are very well qualified to help them fast track into getting the practice? There seems to be, I've known a lot of doctors over time who've ended up being nursing aides, nurses, you know, or doing other tasks besides medicine for which they were trained for just because they were not trained in Canada. So that's one comment, because we cry about lack of doctors, but on the flip side, it doesn't seem to be any effort to bring in more doctors and bring them up to speed. And the other comment was when you were talking about do bugs need drugs and the good bugs that we have in our system. Are we today raising little children in a very sterile environment? Because I know mothers panic when they just touch the door and they're there with their you know, sanitizers and cleaning them up, and they drop something on the floor and they immediately throw away. And so I don't know if it's a 5-second rule or a 10-second rule, but I'll pick it up and put it in my mouth without any qualms. So just comments about those couple of things. Quite different. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your questions. The first question is in a completely different direction, right? The first question is looking at the lack of MDs. We need more MDs, and what about foreign trained MDs? The reality is that a lot of the reason that we don't have enough MDs, because we have a lot of MDs, is because we have increasing numbers and numbers of sick people, and until you begin to address why we have all these sick people, you know, no matter how many MDs we have, I don't know that it's ever going to be enough. The current, you know, the rate of rise of economics with regards to consumption of healthcare services per capita has gone from about, I don't know, 500, and, these are approximate figures, $550 in 1975 to close to $6,000 per person, and it's been going up dramatically. So it's not a matter of insufficient funds and resources spent training MDs and doing stuff like that. And there are way more people seeing naturopaths now, as I mentioned before, and alternative providers. So from my perspective, no matter how many MDs you train, and there may be well-trained people coming from afar, until we change the fundamental paradigm of the way MDs are trained and the way they practice medicine, to going back to the concept of addressing the cause of illness rather than just using interventions to mitigate symptoms, I don't think any number of physicians will adequately address the problem. That's my belief, and I think the science and the literature supports that. And if our public policy people continue to just discuss, you know, private healthcare versus public healthcare and how we're going to do this service and that service, without addressing what's causing this healthcare crisis, which is declining health of our population, then I don't think we're going to be successful. Let me address your second comment, is with regards to the sort of particular concern that some people have with regards to germ. I completely agree, right? Exposure to germs is part of what induces your immune system to become healthy. There was a publication in the New England Journal looking at farm children compared who eat dirt, right? Compared to those, and they had, you know,
and
much
yellow snow.
right, exactly. So that their immune systems are better, and you know, in terms of using disinfectants and keeping children indoors. I mean, if we look at indoor air, there's lots of off-gassing within indoors from various things. Various disinfectants have incredibly toxic, potent compounds, which you inhale into your body and through your goes through the cribriform plate into your brain. And so not only are many children inside being exposed to things, they're
they're not getting exposure to things that they should. But there was a recent paper also looking at vaginal deliveries, because the cesarean section rate in many areas is about 30% now. Okay, it's gone up like exponentially for various reasons that I won't take the time to go into. But part of the way that the child gets that germ environment is when they go through the vagina and the birth canal of the mom, the child is exposed to all kinds of germs there and then gets exposed, and then it's part of a, it appears to be the source of some of the probiotic germ environment of the body. And those who get born delivered by a cesarean section do not get the advantage of that probiotic environment. So this idea of keeping, you know, this sterile environment that is required for our children, you're absolutely right, it's potentially counterproductive in developing that human microbiome that we require for proper health and well-being. Thank you for your question.
Thank you, Dr. Janice. We'll take a break for 10 to 15 minutes. Steeps will refresh your tea, and then we'll come back after you've talked with each other about this in about 10 or 15 minutes. Welcome back. We'll begin our second part here for the next little while. I hope you've got a bit more tea and had a bit of a chance to reflect on these things.
Thank you. We were talking a little bit earlier about the idea of preventative health care, and I feel a lot of people really underestimate the role that mental health plays in our general health with its correlations with the nervous system, how integral that is to the body. I just wanted to know if you have any thoughts on that, and especially like with the toxicology element, how our various stress hormones can influence our day-to-day health.
Thank you very, very much for your question. As I mentioned, I think it's alarming, the rise in mental health problems that we're seeing. And I have seen a number of teenagers over the last year who've suffered from profound depression, and often, and in most cases, it's not because they have a lot of emotional baggage or a lot of hurts or abuses, often coming from the situations where they are loved and cared for and no apparent reason. And the mental health world has moved from this idea that mental illness is the result of psychological stressors, but they've moved to this idea that it is a chemical imbalance. I'm sure you've heard that term. The question is, though, is what's causing the chemical imbalance, right? And most people have assumed, once again, that it's genetic predestination. You have a chemical imbalance, so you've got depression or bipolar illness or anxiety disorder or autism or whatever you have. But I don't believe that that's what the science is showing. The model has been diagnose the mental illness and intervene with some kind of pharmaceutical preparation, and the person will be on chronic drugs. But if you look at the Hippocratic model, you can then say, okay, this person does have a mental illness, and in the acute situation, you may have to intervene by using whatever is necessary. But what I do with my patients, and I believe is where this mental health professions should be going, is what's causing that mental illness. Now, most people have felt that, it's because of psychological stressors. And I must say that psychological toxicity is absolutely one kind of toxicity. But in most of the people that I have seen who have significant mental illnesses, I find other things, and when you correct their deficiencies and address the toxic components, then they improve so much that these stressors seem insignificant. Right? Now, I have a paper that's published in a neurotoxicology journal, so it's a mainstream scientific journal, called Toxic Causes of Mental Illness Are Overlooked. And there are many examples I could give you of cases that I've seen, but I'll give you one. I had a gentleman who
was brought to me by his daughter, who is a nurse, and he's given me permission to talk about him. And when he came to see me, he was brought in by the wife and the daughter. He basically was non-communicative. And the story was that he had dementia and had to be admitted to a nursing home, was the recommendation by the psychiatrist, and basically that there really wasn't any hope that he had this chronic affliction. So they were brought, they brought him to me, and I had the opportunity to just chat with the family, and they said, is there anything that you can do for him? And I didn't know at that time. I said, but if you want, we'll do all that we can. So we started an investigation, and so the procedure that I do is I have a book. It's 85 pages. People fill out this book, so I find out everything from them, from to find out what caused their problems. I then do a bunch of investigations, and what we found with this gentleman is that he came from Holland. And when he came to Canada in his 20s, he got a job working in a stained glass window place. And he was making stained glass windows where he was heating up the metal to put the glass in. So, and then he soon after developed severe bipolar illness and suffered, horribly with this illness for most of his young life, and then developed the dementia. So when we did investigations on him, we did a whole number of things. I found that he had massive amounts of lead in his system, okay? And we know that lead accumulates in the brain and can cause psychiatric illness. Beethoven, for example, had lead exposure, they found recently, and he also had manic depressive illness, as they call it. Anyways, so likely the lead came from when he was heating the rims of the stained glass windows, right? So he had massive amounts of lead. We then got the lead out, so to speak, using some various treatments that bind lead and remove it. But the thing was, is that, I was sort of cautiously very excited when I found this. So I told the family, and they went to the psychiatrist and said, we saw this guy, and he said that, their loved one had lead accumulation in the body. Now, the psychiatrist said, that's a bunch of crap. This, what kind of quack lunatic you're seeing? I'll show you that it's a bunch of nonsense. And so he said, I'll do a blood test and a urine test for lead, and I'll show you that there's no lead there. So he did that, and in fact, the blood and urine test came back with no lead. So they came to me and they said, well, they did this test here at the local lab, the lead exposure was when he was in his 20s, many years ago. Lead doesn't stay in the blood and come out in the urine. Lead goes and deposits in the cells in the brain and in bone. So it doesn't show in the blood. The blood is the most potent area, and the body, in its attempt to protect itself, shuttles toxicants that it's unable to unload into cells to put them in the closet. So that's why his test didn't show anything. So I showed them the objective test, because we do a technique to mobilize the lead from storage sites and then to bind it and pull it out into the urine. And he had massive amounts of lead. So then what we did is we used treatments over the next, 18 months to pull this stuff out of him. And I just never forget the day that this guy came in, sort of, they'd come in every couple of weeks as we were in the process, and he would always sort of be out of it. And then one day he began to speak up, and then started joking around, and he became this increasingly, wonderful, humorous guy who would tease his wife, and he got off his medications and has done wonderfully. He was lead poisoned. So this is one example. Another really common one that I've seen, a couple teenagers in the last year, is that they had mold, indoor mold growing in their suite or in their rooms. And indoor mold is very, very different than outdoor mold, because outdoor mold every day is killed by a frequency from the sun. But when mold is growing inside, it is in a competitive environment, and it releases what are called mycotoxins. And these are chemicals that are released by molds. And some of them will alter brain function. And so in two of the young people that I saw over the last year, we addressed the mold in their situation, got it out, treated them to get the mold out of their bodies, and they're perfectly fine now. So
you know, when people come in and they, you know, they're under stress and stuff like that and they have a psychiatric condition, I'm always asking why? Like, what's causing them? So I'm not minimizing the input of stress, but sometimes stress is way out of, it's taken way out of proportion because the chemistry of the brain is not as it should be. Okay? Thank you. We have a class on mental health at my office if you're ever interested, if anybody's interested. We have classes on Thursdays and Saturdays. You can call my office and they'll give you a schedule, and if anybody wants to learn more about any specific aspect, they can send you a schedule. Okay? Thank you.
This is on a little bit of a tangent, okay. But what are the different interactions between a PhD and an MD and how they go and generate the research process to go and determine all the clinical practices that you do in your offices and hospitals?
Okay. Thank you for your question. So the PhD and MD. My wife is a PhD, and I'm an MD. Now, PhDs are often involved in doing a lot of the research work. They're doing the basic science often. And you have some PhD MDs often who are involved in doing scientific research and that. MDs, depending on what field they're in, many are clinicians. There are some that are involved in research. But there is a disconnect between what a lot of the basic science and the PhDs have found and what the MDs know. Because most MDs, they're so busy. We don't have enough. They're trying to care for people, trying to feed their families. They're run off their feet. And so there isn't a lot of motivation and not a lot of time for them to be reading research journals and to think about how that applies to their practice. So we have this massive gulf between what's in the scientific world. But the other thing is that the basic scientists may know what they found in their lab, but may not necessarily know how that translates into clinical medicine and dealing with patients, right? So I'm very privileged because I'm doing both, right? So I'm able to take this and to apply it. But who funds most of the clinical research? It's mostly all funded by industry. And they're funding things not to make people healthy, but to find out what intervention they can use so that there's benefit for them as well. I mean, let's be serious, right? So if somebody is funding something, they're usually funding something for a reason, something that's going to support what they're... So almost all clinical research is funded by industry. Most of the basic science is funded not by industry, but by public sources. And so there is a disconnect, right? And so it is definitely something that needs to be addressed. Thank you for a really important question.
I'd like to take the question of mental health in a somewhat different direction.
Sure.
And ask you what role you might envisage, or if you envisage a role, for the spiritual factors in health, in a total healthcare picture.
Thank you very much. That's also a critically important question. The World Health Organization said that health is just not the absence of disease. It's well-being in the physical, right, mental, social, and spiritual domains. And, you know, I really appreciate that because we are spiritual beings, right? And, but there's one thing that, on a practical basis, pastors and priests and rabbis and other religious people, their office these days are flooded with people coming in with mental health problems. And it's very common that such problems will be attributed to spiritual causation, right? Because sometimes when people's brain chemistry is altered, because our spirituality is part of our brain chemistry, part of the way that they see the world and the way that they perceive spirituality is also altered. And so a lot of loving, caring, religious people struggle with people who have mental health problems where there appears to be a spiritual component as well. What do I suggest? Once again, I believe in this model of causation. If there are spiritual problems that have spiritual causes, then the solution is spiritual. But if there are spiritual manifestations that have an underlying, you know, chemical disorder, you've got to find out what's causing that chemical disruption, correct it, and most of those spiritual problems evaporate. I have seen it over and over and over again. It is astonishing how many people who have mental health problems who are often struggling with ultimate questions about why? Why me? Why am I not being helped? You know, all the things I believed in. And so often, because their personhood is being challenged, because their mental health is all altered, they are asking those fundamental questions. So spiritual questions are often a big part of those struggling with mental illness. But when you address the underlying biochemistry, and by correcting deficiencies and addressing toxicities, once again, often you see these things resolve and dramatic improvement. So I absolutely believe in the spiritual component of our lives, but I always believe in people getting their physical house in order, because the brain is a physical organ, okay? And in order for our thinking, our moods, our relationships, our social interactions, all that rests on the basic physical functioning of the brain. Thank you.
Puts a rational point of view, which I can understand.
Thank you.
I'm shocked that you're satisfied, Professor Wickenden.
I might argue with some aspect of it at some stage.
Okay.
And I will just mention, I mean, you were the satisfaction has triggered another thing, is the whole area of sexuality, right? We're sexual beings as well. And many people who have mental health issues, it affects their sexuality, and sometimes people will behave in ways that they, you know, if they had good mental health, those aren't the choices they would have made, right? And so sometimes people are making decisions in the sexual area, sometimes in the behavioral area, so they're getting involved in crime and behaviors that they otherwise would not get involved with. And so when a person's brain is disordered because of altered chemistry, it often manifests in a multiplicity of ways that often causes grief for that person in the long run and for their loved ones. And so it's so important at early stages when people are having issues in the mental health area to intervene early on in the process rather than waiting till they're way down and have had a lot of problems that have resulted. Thank you.
Talking about mental health, there is still such a lot of stigma. And as you mentioned earlier, mental health diseases are on the rise. And yet, we're not able to talk about them as freely or discuss them as freely. So what comes first, the chicken or the egg? How do we deal with this issue? Because there is still so much stigma about it. And the first thing the physicians would go to is the drugs. And so then that's where they stagnate.
Thank you very much. It's really an important comment. Yeah, there is a lot of stigma around, and a lot of people themselves sometimes feel that somehow they're less worthy because their view of themselves is disordered as well. And often they will, you know, sometimes behave in certain ways that they're not proud of. And even if they recover, they're having to live with some of the things that they may have done at a time of compromise. And often their loved ones are looking at them in why is this happening? I think of postpartum depression, for example, where a woman who may be, you know, happy, excited about having a baby, and then has the child and goes into a profound depression, and there have been people who've taken the lives of their children, taken their own lives, and people think, you know, what kind of a bad person was this, right? And so it's hard for people on the outside to get a glimpse into that world of the agony going on for someone who is mentally ill. And another thing that typically happens is sometimes those with mental illness, once it begins to get increasingly severe, is that they begin to see their relationships as disordered, and they often will turn on their loved ones and often accuse them of things that aren't real because sometimes they're seeing things in a disordered way and will often blame them for their suffering. All kinds of things happen. And so often people around don't know how to take this. It's a very, very difficult situation. Now, in terms of how I deal with it, I will say that when I have patients who come to me with mental health problems, I will not take them on their own. Because often they're not at a place that they can appropriate the information or even necessarily provide me with all the stuff I need. So I always insist that if I'm going to do all I can for them, that they have a person that comes with them who they will be accountable so that I can deal with that person who has good mental health, so that that person will be accountable, so that I know that what needs to be carried out is in fact done. Okay, so I didn't do that when I started doing environmental medicine many years ago, and I learned the importance of having someone there with them. But when you address causation and these people improve, it is incredible to see. And in order to address the stigma in the family and the reservation that the family members and the community may have about them, I have an open and honest discussion that this wasn't this person's fault. And in fact, their suffering, like C.S. Lewis wrote in his book, The Problem of Pain, there's an epilogue at the end where he has one of his close colleagues, a medical practitioner, talk about suffering in terms of what he has seen. And he said in the book that in the whole realm of medicine, there is nothing so horrible as someone suffering from chronic melancholia, which is chronic depression. So in terms of the perspective, these people, it's not like having, you know, an itchy nose or something. This is profound suffering. So to make those around them apprised of the degree of suffering, that this is not moral feebleness, that this is not an inadequate personality or any kind of, you know, deficiency on their part, that they're as people. And then to address any behavior, any comments, anything that they've done in the time of sickness as being related to this causative factor. And as long as that causative factor is addressed, there should be no reason for this to come back. That this is not a predestination affliction. So I think that when you begin to make people aware of themselves and to build them up when you have addressed their problem, and to have all those around them hearing from a professional about the truth of what's going on, that it goes an awfully long way to correcting any stigma and to engendering compassion for that individual, and also keeping them accountable so that they are careful to look after their health. Thank you.
Thank you. Very, very illuminating presentation. I thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm a physician myself, as a psychiatrist, as a matter of fact.
Fantastic.
I'd like to add to your theme of toxicity causing illness. Perhaps it needs to be addressed. Many toxicities are due to excesses in life.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm thinking you brought up sexuality, certainly excessive sex, whatever that means, excessive drinking, even drinking of water, excessive eating, excessive sugars, salt. So certainly, in terms of lifestyle, we can all be more responsible in terms of the healthcare system. If there are deficiencies in our system, I think each one of us can take some responsibilities to prevent ourselves having to use the system by cutting off excesses.
Thank you very much for your comments. I really appreciate it, Doctor. Thank you for adding those. Absolutely. Various excesses are absolutely toxic. I mean, I'll just give you one example. Fructose. Fructose is a sugar that's being used all over the place, right? It's, you know, it has many, many different names, and it's often the main ingredient in most processed foods these days, right? Fructose is being identified as a poison in the research literature. Okay? So getting fructose from fruit is one thing, rather than getting massive amounts in various processed foods. So it's one of the most prime toxins that that is ubiquitous all around us. It's altering GI function. It causes pro-inflammatory cytokines. It affects something called nitric oxide in the blood vessels, which we need to open up our blood vessels to get proper circulation. There's all kinds of toxins that are around us in excesses. But I'm going to say one thing on the other side, too, about overeating. We have an epidemic of obesity now, and a lot of it has to do with fructose consumption. But on the other side, there are some people who just diet and diet and diet religiously, and they still are unable to lose weight. And people assume, oh, it's these gut and sort of thing. It recently has been found that a number of toxic chemicals that accumulate in the body act as what's called obesogens. And they control the metabolism of adipose tissue and block the breakdown of fat cells. So I'm always hesitant when I judge someone who may have a certain appearance, because one never knows what's going on behind that appearance. Thank you so much for your comment.
Is there anyone else who'd like to raise a theme or issue?
One of Hippocrates' contemporaries was Plato, and in the Republic, he mentions that people are getting sick because of their unhealthy lifestyle and unhealthy diets, which come with too much affluence, he claimed. I'm just wondering, do you think that some sort of major change in our lifestyle, in particular with our dietary habits, is called for in this society?
Thank you, Martin. Absolutely. I think on many fronts. And one of my talks is exploring the habits of the healthy. And one of the things that I have enjoyed doing over the last number of years is looking at the habits and the lifestyles of those who don't get sick, right? Because in medicine, most of the attention is looking at illness, right? Rather than studying, like, if you wanted to play basketball, you'd read books and learn about people who play basketball really well, not people who have failed at basketball, right? Yet in medicine, somehow we focus on the sick. If we're supposed to be health providers providing health, we should understand what healthy people do to maintain their health, right? And so I have been exploring, and I'm just putting together this lecture at the moment, and there are a number of factors that I have found that are consistently found in cultures where people don't get chronic illness, and where they, where they lead reasonably healthy lives and have, longer life expectancy of health, right? And so there are a number of things, but diet is huge. Diet is huge. It's important to get, like I mentioned, vitamin D. That's a really critical one. The getting the essential fatty acids is another. This DHA compound, the widespread deficiency, is another really important one. But it's really important in our diets to watch the foods that we're putting into us. If you're putting food into you that is contaminated with toxicants and has toxic chemicals in it, then you are putting into your body massive exposure. Now, let me give one example. I love eating seafood. I love it. It's got all kinds of DHA in it, all this good stuff. The concern, though, is that all the stuff that's going down the toilet, all the pharmaceuticals that people take, all the agricultural runoff, a lot of the stuff from industry, stuff raining down from the atmosphere, all that stuff goes into the water. But it doesn't stay in the water. It gets into the algae, right? It gets into the plants, and then it gets into the fish. So, and then the fish many of them are unable to detoxify these compounds. And the big fish, you eat the moderate fish, you eat the small fish, and as you go up the food chain, these toxins bioaccumulate. So by the time that I eat, you know, my tuna, that big fish has accumulated through its whole life all the toxins by eating the smaller fish. And they have found, like, concentrations tens and hundreds of thousands higher of chemicals within the meat of the fish compared to the water around them, because they've been accumulating. And then you get that all in one hit when you eat it. So I am cautious with regards to certain kinds of food, including seafood, because I have a fellow from BC, again, giving me permission to chat about him, completely and totally disabled. The guy has a master's, wonderful man, but totally disabled. When we assessed him, he was loaded with mercury, okay, as well as other things. I'm looking, where does this guy get all this mercury from? Well, he eats fish, you know, 2 to 3 times a week, because he's heard that it's healthy, right? And so one of the things is I caution you with regards to what you're putting into the precious body of yours, because it's really easy to get toxic stuff in, and it's pretty hard to get it out. So in order to be well, you need clean air. So you have to look at the air that you're breathing. Are you breathing chemicals? Where you work, where you live, in your house? Are there chemicals that are... Because although we eat 3 to 4 liters of... Eat and drink 3 to 4 liters a day, we breathe 8 to 10,000 liters of air a day. So if you're breathing toxic material in your workplace or wherever you are, all this stuff is going to get into you, right? So you need clean air. You need clean water. So the water that you're drinking, is it water that has the birth control pill in it? Is it water that has other pharmaceuticals in it? I mean, where are you getting your water and what's in it, right? So clean air, clean water, clean food, right? And the electrical area is an emerging area, which I won't get into too much, but there is increasing concern about certain kind of electrical frequencies and what they do to people, right? And so, yes, we need an overhaul.
Yeah, but you can see where this is going now. I mean, when you start talking about clean air and clean water, and you're even talking about the ocean, right? I mean, what you're calling for is a radical revision of our whole industrial way of life. I mean, because it's the kind of industries that we have which are pouring all these pollutants into the air, the ocean, and the groundwater. It's we're getting into areas where, you know, not many people are going to want to tread.
Right. And is it any wonder that we have an epidemic of chronic illness that's getting worse and worse and worse that's affecting children? I believe that these questions do have to be asked from a public policy perspective. But I'm not a public policy person. I'm just an ordinary doc, right? And so on an individual basis, though, there is lots you can do to take your exposure burden from here down to here and to secure that you're getting and your family is getting what it needs and that you're avoiding exposures. And by doing those things in your life, it can be life-changing. That's what I see every day in my practice. Okay. Thank you.
What kind of water do you recommend we drink?
Okay. And remember what W.C. Fields said about water.
Okay. Sorry, I'm not familiar with that.
And fish. What did you say? Well, W.C. Fields only drank beer because of what happens in water with fish.
Thank you. Oh. Sorry, I'm slow. With regards to water, you know, it's a long discussion, and we have a class just on water because it's a big area. But there are, you know, this whole movement towards, you know, bottled water, water delivery services, water filtration. More and more people are getting into this because it's a concern. There wouldn't be these booming businesses if there wasn't an issue here, right? Now, if you ask me, as I've looked at the whole spectrum of water options, there isn't any perfect option, right? Because I ask, okay, what if we look back the way water was a long time ago and the way that in nature water was provided to us, what does water have? Well, it's got the water and it has lots of good minerals that our body needs. And the water tends to be more alkaline because of the minerals in the water. The issue now is all the contamination in the water. So what you would like is the water that's alkaline with the minerals and to remove all the toxicants. That's what I would like. But there is no filtration system that has a brain that can say, okay, you're a toxicant, you're a mineral, I'm going to put you in and take the other out. So there isn't. So some people have tried systems where they will try to remove all the toxicants to purify everything and then to add minerals back in by putting some rocks in there or stuff like that. But then you've got to ask, where are those rocks from and what's in those rocks and all that, you know, where do they come from? So there is no perfect system. If you ask me what personally we use in our house, I'll tell you. We use a distiller that has some filtration in it as well, okay? And the reason we do that is in the research that I've done, it has the best ability with the distillation and subsequent filtration to remove everything from the water. So there you have pure water because, you know, I have four boys. I don't want them to be consuming their oral contraceptive and a whole bunch of other things, right? So if you take everything out, and how do we restore some alkalinity and some minerals back is I use something called white tea, okay? So white tea has tons of minerals, and it also has lots of other incredible nutrients. It's got this series of compounds called catechins, which have many, many benefits for the body. So I get white tea, but I'm careful where I get white tea from because where it's grown is also an issue. So, you know, I order white tea. I get it from a grower in Hawaii that I like and trust. I've tested for chemicals a bunch of white tea. So I have white tea at my office, and I bring it in for my patients, right? And so what I do is this white tea you can re-steep four or five times. So I steep it once, and then I put it in a tea ball, stainless steel tea ball, and I just put it in a jug of distilled water in the fridge. And then it leaches its minerals and other good stuff into the water. That's the best that I know of at the moment, right? There's no perfect system. But it's the best that I've figured out thus far with the research that I've done. Thank you.
Where does the Edmonton water system fit into all of this?
Well, I don't want to criticize the people at the Edmonton water system, but, you know, I think it's relatively common knowledge. There has been testing done that some of the toxicants, they don't have the ability to remove them all. Right? That's why if you look at the effluent that's coming, there still are trace amounts of some compounds. And the other thing is that there are things that are added to the water, too, like to control infection, right? And what effect does that have on the germ environment when you drink it? And I don't know that there is sufficient research, but if you're putting in something that kills germs, what kind of impact does it have on your human microbiome, right? So, you know, I haven't personally studied it, but there have been concerns expressed by some people. And so, myself, I prefer to be on the safe side. I don't want any amount of these various chemicals. I don't want chemotherapy agent and antidepressants and anti-inflammatories in any amount accumulating or that my body has to deal with. So I prefer to do the best I can by securing water that way. So that's the route that we've chosen with the knowledge that I have thus far. Okay, thank you.
Well, one final intervention.
Just quickly, so do you see in the future, because we seem to be building all these one-stop shops, an area where an MD would be working in conjunction with someone who has an environmental expertise, working together to address more or less a holistic approach to the illnesses in people? That would be my first thing. And secondly, in the realm of geriatric care, one of the best doctors I've met is the one who looks after my mother and knew right the exact amounts of omega-3s to give her for depression, recognized that perhaps cranberry juice every day is going to eliminate all of her problems, which it did in certain areas. And yeah, there seems to be a few out there that know.
Thank you for your question. First of all, with regards to the future of medicine, I most certainly have no gift of prophecy or anything like that. And so the way that I try to assess what the future brings is by looking at what history has done, right? And when I look at history, in terms of when new information and new things which challenge the prevailing paradigm are presented, they generally take 1 to 2 generations before they're accepted on the streets. Now, with the internet and the ability to reach a lot more of the public, it may be that this continuum will move faster. And I hope that that is the case, because we have a lot of sick people who don't have 1 to 2 generations that they can wait in order to get help. In terms of what I see in the future, I believe it's my belief, like if you gave me 1 week with bright medical students, I believe that I could teach them enough about this information that they could carry out a basic assessment in terms of what to know what to do with all patients. I could teach them about this paradigm and talk to them about how to approach patients and try to instill critical thinking so that they will know what to look for and to challenge the whole paradigm of interventional-based medicine. That's what I would like, but I'm a dreamer, okay? And so will that happen? We'll see what the future brings. The second question with regards to geriatrics, let me tell you, there is so much that can be done for our seniors. I have a paper with another doctor in town on using vitamin D in a nursing home. Okay? I talked about vitamin D deficiencies. You can't believe all the problems, including mood disturbances that occur as a result of vitamin D deficiency. We tested a number of people within a nursing home. The average vitamin D level was like unbelievably low. Why? Because they're not outside, they're not getting exposure to fresh sunlight. So it's completely understandable, right? So simply by repleting them, by using really an expensive supplementation of vitamin D, we were able to bring their levels up substantially, and that resulted in improved clinical outcomes. There is so much that could be done on a population group and for our seniors' population that would be inexpensive, incredibly cost-effective, because we would prevent various illnesses and a lot of suffering. I want to thank you so very much for coming today and listening to what I've had to share with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.